Hey everybody, welcome into a long-awaited another episode of Going Nuclear with myself, Trevor Hall, and the Uranium Insider, Mr. Justin Hune. Justin, my friend, I'm glad you were able to dig yourself out of the Burning Man festival over the weekend to make this appearance.
It was a muddy slog, I tell you. I got a little bit of that playa foot, as they call it, but I came out a stronger man. Thanks for your concern.
We're just kidding. Justin didn't go to Burning Man. At least I don't think he went to Burning Man.
I
think
I didn't, and I actually, it's funny, my wife has been once in the past before her and I met, and she would love to go back and take my stepdaughter, and I have no interest whatsoever in going.
I don't know, like, what is a uranium trader barter with at Burning Man? You know, there's a philosophical question.
That is,
information? Yeah. Pounds of U-308?
Yeah, I'm not really sure. I don't know at that point. I think they needed a lot of things that I couldn't provide, so hard to say what I would barter.
Well, it would have been an inflated market if you were able to barter pounds of U-308 the last few days here, because the spot price, Justin, has continued to move up. In fact, last week we closed above $60 a pound. It had been a little while since the spot market had seen that type of price move. I got to give you credit. You know, you have been pounding the table all throughout this year that this moment in the market was going to come. You felt very certain about it. And here we are. It's seeing a lot of momentum in the last couple of weeks. Before we talk about the equities, let's just kind of talk about the spot market, Justin, and give us kind of a sense of where the feel for this momentum is coming from all of a sudden.
Sure. It's been a really interesting summer, which we've noted to our membership over and over as kind of somewhat of an anomaly. You know, July and August are the slowest months, August specifically. And there's a few things that typically happen in the uranium market during the summer. And that is that a lot of the nuclear utility fuel buyers will go on vacation. And the market just slows down. August is the slowest month of the year for all markets, historically speaking. And what often happens is because there's just of lacking of buying pressure in the spot market and in the term market for July and August, you usually have a stagnation of the price. And oftentimes you'll see the price slip, you know, a few dollars over the course of those couple of months. Of course, there was a major anomaly with the advent of the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust in 2021 in August and their ATM. So at the end of August, they started buying hand over fist. So that was a unique situation, but kind of an exogenous event, not what was typical. What's typical is slow trading, low volumes, not a lot of volumes being purchased or sold in the spot market. The price tends to slip. You get the month-end smash, which is the traders that have offtakes from producers typically will sell a little bit of uranium the last few days of the month to try to drop the month-end closing price of the spot uranium to affect their forward month offtake and save a little bit of money. That hasn't happened. In fact, the opposite has been happening. We've seen still low volume trading, but there has been some buying pressure in the spot market. And the fact that such a low volume in trades in the spot market has been moving the price up is significant. So essentially what we had last month was we had the spot price rise from July month end, $56.25 a pound to where it closed at August month end, $61.10 a pound, up almost $5 during the month of August. That is anomalous action. And I think that has a lot to do with just how thin this market is, how finally coming to an awareness the utilities are in terms of the price action, where the price is going to go. I think a lot of utilities that have sat on the sidelines over the past 18 months kind of seeing if this Ukraine conflict would just go away, if they could go back to business as usual with Russia, if the price spike of last year that happened across the fuel cycle would come back down. It hasn't. Conversion and enrichment continue to rise. Finally, that's trickling down to U-308 as we predicted last year. And I think this is just the start of it.
Yeah. So what's interesting about SPUT is that, you know, they didn't make a single purchase of a single pound of uranium for a couple months, actually. Then they raised, it was just under $1 million at the end of August. And so obviously they have been coming and buying. And I'm just kind of curious, if is this maybe like the catalyst? Is that the catalyst for the move of SPUT coming in, the first week of September and buying that could help raise this price?
I would say probably not. Okay. And you know, it could have some influence in that what we've seen, if you actually chart, you know, the discount to NAV for SPUT, which has been persistent for 6 months, right? So the last time they raised cash before last week was in February. The last time they bought pounds was in April. And I think it was only 100,000 pounds. So they've essentially been completely hamstrung and out of the market for at least 6 months and mostly out of the market for almost a year. But what's happened over the past, let's say, 2 months or so is that discount to NAV has started to kind of make these higher lows. And it's getting closer and closer and closer to NAV. And when the market goes ever so slightly risk off and SPUT dips back down again, instead of going to a 10% discount to NAV, it went to 5%. So in some cases, what's happened in the past is when risk starts to come back onto the sector and SPUT starts to trade closer to NAV, you'll have some traders coming in and buying in the spot market, expecting that Sprott will be buying over the next number of weeks and they can, you know, arb a couple of bucks a pound maybe. So perhaps that had somewhat of an influence in August. That's possible. But they haven't been doing any purchasing of pounds whatsoever. So you can't say that SPUT purchasing is leading to this move. And I actually think that SPUT has been less relevant in the latest move than they ever have been. So they had a really interesting announcement, if you want to talk about that briefly, that just came out this morning. But yeah, the spot market has been firming up for a very long time. And there's just, you know, what we wrote about in this morning's newsletter, the September newsletter that went out this morning, is basically the flex in the system is gone. You know, there's no more levers for the utilities to pull to avert buying directly from producers that have pounds available. There's no carry trade pounds available, very little. It's very difficult for the carry traders to operate in this environment with a super thin spot market and high interest rates. SPUT is obviously not trading at a premium to NAV, which is, you know, when it does and when Sprott is buying, then the carry traders that do have pounds still held in the books can sell the Sprott if it's a backwardated market. It's not a backwardated market. There's just not a lot of above ground mobile inventory. And so the utilities that are uncovered in the near term have to pay up for it. And that's moving the spot price. Those that are uncovered, you know, going out 4 or 5 years out, they have to step up basically now because the primary producers are essentially sold out of material for the next few years. It's just an extremely thin market. There's not a lot of buffer out there. And there's not a lot of options for the utilities other than literally going and buying U308, which is what they're doing.
And the reason I asked that question here, Justin, is because, you know, the last move we had in the spot price of uranium, it felt like it was when SPUT hit the market, when that trust hit the market. There was a lot of enthusiasm, momentum behind the spot price. And obviously they were coming in buying as they were launching that trust. And so, but it settled down. Now, you don't want, I guess, in big bull market, at least in the spot price, you don't want to be, you know, the one mechanism that lifts all boats, do you? I mean, so we want something that is all encompassing. And so, I mean, despite, you know, only raising less than $1 million the end of August and maybe coming in and buying a little bit the first few days of September, you know, this rise, I mean, it feels a lot healthier than it would be if it was just them doing the purchases.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that's a really good point. If you chart spot uranium, it's this gigantic, long-term, absolutely gorgeous ascending triangle. And it had a spike that went through that resistance line, to your point, last April. So Sprott was buying a lot of uranium last April. The markets were, you know, risk on across the board prior to the, you know, the tanking of the market at the end of that month. But either way, the uranium equities were flying. Sprott was buying like crazy and you had this big spike. And so there's a lot of, you know, watching this chart and looking for the breakout to new highs. And we're just about there because I think we hit 63, 64 bucks last April. But yeah, that was entirely driven by SPUT, entirely driven by SPUT. Of course, it was like 2 months after the initiation of the invasion of Ukraine. So there was a lot of questions around that. And I think that had some influence on that move as well. But now this, with SPUT completely out of the market, we're actually having sector fundamentals start to move the price. And we've had that over the years, right? It hasn't been only SPUT, but SPUT, in my opinion, has already done the hard work that they needed to do. You know, they accumulated over 40 million pounds of uranium that was above ground excess mobile inventory over the course of, you know, 12 months. They did that, really, which is phenomenal. It's absolutely insane that they've been able to purchase that much uranium, but they cleared out a lot of that buffer. And now that it's gone and there's not much flex in the system, then we're actually seeing small amounts of purchasing move the price that's not coming from the financials.
Yeah. And you know, I love narratives. I am a narrative guy. That's why I rely on you on the micro details behind the uranium market. But there's been a couple stories in the last couple of weeks, Justin. I mean, since the last time you and I published an episode, that I think are just kind of incredible. They might be a little bit dated now, but since this is the first time you and I have talked in a while, I think they're worthy to come up. Like, I've seen headlines that maybe some of these NGOs were off kilter with their messaging against uranium, and that's about to turn. I've heard headlines of Greenpeace maybe changing their directive towards uranium and nuclear energy. Kathy Wood, our favorite tech investor, whatever you may think about Kathy Wood and her technology investments behind ARC, she seems very bullish on Cameco, which I think a lot of people are stuck with foots in their mouth, some uranium investors at the time. So, Druckenmiller's been in and out of Cameco as well. And so it's really interesting to see the narrative really transition and evolve over time. Then who knows? I mean, does uranium become a tech investor favorite in the commodity sector here?
That's entirely possible, and that's one of the reasons why I'm so excited to be talking with Adam Rosenzweig today, is because they cover broad commodities. You know, they released this document just a few weeks ago, this Q2 market commentary, and you know, they have a decent amount of money and assets under management. They manage a fund that's commodities focused. They follow commodities and have been for a very long time. And they're pounding the table on uranium here and kind of lumping it in with gold and oil and nat gas and copper in this document as, you know, where they want to be positioned for this decade and taking a very broad zoomed out view. It's entirely possible. And I think how uranium really shines right now is one of the big fears in the markets has to do with recession. That is, you know, we're seeing increasing, you know, metrics that are showing that that is, you know, here or coming. And there's concerns about deflationary effects on commodities, right? In a recessionary environment, that hasn't been the case yet for oil, really, and that probably has more to do with supply than demand. But you know, looking at the uranium price, it clearly has no effects from this, and it's very simple to explain. It's a necessary commodity for the operation of existing power plants. Period. The end. It can't be replaced. Power plants don't really utilize less uranium in a recession versus when, you know, it's business as usual. Maybe they flex down a little bit in their electricity production, some, but when you're the primary baseload producer in any given area, you don't really flex down that production. And so the consumption of uranium, especially when we take into some other metrics that he highlighted in this document as well, like commercial inventories on by utilities of uranium are historically low. So it doesn't really matter if we go into recession and some of the reactors flex down 5% or whatever. They need to buy to buffer their inventories. They need to buy to cover their future needs. And this is all happening in an environment where we're seeing increasing life extensions of existing plants. We're seeing accelerated restarts in Japan. And there's 60 reactors being constructed in the world right now. China has already had 6 construction starts this year, and they're looking for possibly an additional 8 construction starts in the next 4 months. I mean, they're going all out. It's totally wild. So the backdrop for the growth of nuclear and at least the sustenance of nuclear is very clear, on top of low commercial inventories, a rising uranium price environment. And it's like recession, no recession, doesn't matter. This commodity is going to move. And that makes it kind of unique amongst the commodity space.
Yeah. All right. Well, you dropped the curtain on who our guest was this week. So I'm looking forward to having Adam on, because I know we're going to be talking specifically uranium, but I think I'd love to pick his brain on a number of different commodities we cover here on the Clear Commodity Network. But Justin, thanks so much for getting him in. So should we go touch base with Adam here?
Yeah, let's do it, Trevor.
It is with great pleasure that we welcome in managing partner over at Gehring and Rosenzweig. That is Mr. Adam Rosenzweig. Adam, welcome to the Going Nuclear podcast with Justin and myself. Thanks for coming on.
Oh, thank you for having me. Really looking forward to it.
It's really a shame that we're only limited to uranium here, because you guys have been writing some incredible analysis and a kind of looking ahead in the complete commodity sector, even precious metals. So maybe in another time we can have you on to some of the other podcasts on Clear Commodity Network, including Mining Stock Daily. But let's focus with the uranium sector here, because Justin and I have just been really excited to kind of pin you down here and open some things up based on your second quarter outlook that you guys published a couple of weeks ago.
Well, thanks for having me, and you know, I'll come back as long as your listeners can stomach it, and so we'll find that level, and then we'll pair it back from there.
Very good.
Yeah, it's great to have you here, Adam, and really good to meet you. I don't know if you're familiar with us and our work, but we publish a uranium-focused newsletter called Uranium Insider, and we've been doing this since 2019 and been following the sector for a couple of years before that. And the fundamentals for the sector have only improved during that time for the most part, despite the fact that the equities have done what equities can do sometimes. And you and your partner, Lee Gehring, you recently published your second quarter commentary in a piece entitled Golden Foresight: When Speculation Meets History. This report was very well received, very widely circulated. You covered gold, uranium, oil, nat gas, copper, all of which were prefaced with a really intriguing story of a hypothetical future self reminiscing in the year 2029 on his investing decisions of the previous decade. I thought this introduction was really beautifully written. I enjoyed it as somebody who enjoys to write and read and enjoys language. I loved it.
Well, that's very kind. Thank you.
Yeah.
we decided to, we figured, you know, if there's ever going to be a time of the year to write something a little bit more, you know, flowery and fun, why not be when people are sitting on the beach somewhere? You can only read about oil type curves so long. So we figured we should do something a little bit more creative.
Yeah. Yeah. And this hypothetical future situation basically was reflecting on the previous decade's commodity kind of super cycle that seems like you all are pointing towards. And there were multiple instances in reading this document, I found myself pounding the table, especially in the uranium section. So I'm going to start with a quote from this piece, if that's okay, and lead into a question. So a quote from your Q2 piece: our model suggests uranium's strong performance has just started. Uranium has likely reached a pivotal inflection point that could force the price higher by as much as 3 to 4-fold over the next several years. For the first time in history, uranium has slipped into a persistent and widening deficit. We believe the results will be dramatic, unquote. Adam, you and Lee have been following this uranium market for years. What is it that has you so constructive right now?
Well, you know, it's so interesting. The uranium market, as opposed to the oil market or the gas market, where, you know, traders hang on to the inventory data released every Wednesday and Thursday, and, you know, people sort of moves at a frenetic pace. The uranium market really moves in these long chapters. And as a student of history and a student of market history, I think it's really fascinating to go back and look. You know, we had a uranium mining boom in the 1960s, where basically, nuclear power, commercial nuclear power, was becoming a real thing, you know, after obviously the nuclear age was kind of shown to the world at the end of World War II. By the, you know, the 1960s, this was going to be the future. This is when, for those who saw Oppenheimer, Mr. Strauss, you know, who's featured prominently in the movie, he goes on to make a statement later, which was kind of ridiculed for, where he said, nuclear power is going to be so abundant, electricity will be so cheap, it won't even need meters. The cost of a meter and the cost of reading a meter will be far in excess of the amount of electricity or the cost of the electricity. So we'll just kind of give it to people on faith a little bit. And there's this huge push all the way back in the 1960s, which resulted in a massive mining boom and ultimately too much production coming on. You know, then you had a period of time through the 1980s, 90s, and early 2000s where we went exactly the opposite direction, and mine supply basically collapsed almost, you know, dramatically, not to zero, but dramatically. The U.S. went from being the largest uranium producer in the world to not producing anything. And we subsisted off of our military and government stockpiles that had accumulated during the Cold War. And then we reached this inflection point for the first time and call it the middle 2000s, when a lot of that inventory had kind of worked itself out. And we were now in this situation where it was like a normal commodity market again, where you had mine supply, you had reactor demand, and they should probably have something to do with one another and kind of more or less meet. And of course, you didn't. And that's when we saw prices go from $9 to $150 a pound. And what's unusual about the uranium markets is that if you look at the total cost to a utility, the fuel is almost nothing, right? And so you can take it from 90 to 150 and it doesn't move the needle because the capital cost is much more important. Gas is the opposite. Coal is the opposite. They're cheap to spin up, but then you pay a lot in fuel. And so the dynamics of the fuel buyer become really different. And no sooner than that boom took place, you had Fukushima, and obviously you had a massive, massive reduction in reactor demand, first in Japan and then throughout Europe, and to a certain extent, some early retirements in the US as well. And you built up another big surplus. And so, you know, you go back from the dawn of the nuclear age and you kind of move from mining boom surplus to deficit, whittling down stockpiles to, you know, surplus because reactors fell offline. And now, for the first time, and we can debate, you know, whether it was the fourth quarter of last year, the fourth quarter of this year, the second quarter of next year, but you're getting awfully close to this moment. And I think it's probably happening right as we speak, just looking at how the market is behaving, where you've worked off of all those stockpiles again, and you're left with this sort of now persistent reality that reactor demand is 190 million pounds and growing. Mine supply is 140 million pounds and flat. And what do you do with the difference? You know, you had relied on these stockpiles for really the better part of the last 60 years.
Yeah.
And there's not a clear stockpile to look for now. So that's kind of the backdrop. We became involved. We've been involved in the uranium industry off and on since the early 2000s. We participated in that first run up really well. We actually sold most of our holdings near the top. So one of the rare times where, you know, we're quite good on research and on macro calls. We're not as good on timing, but that was one of the rare ones we got right. In 2011, after Fukushima, when everything collapsed, we said, well, this is overdone, and we bought. That was a mistake. And we've been on the sidelines from, call it, 2012 to 2018. And in 2018, we said, well, it's a long time here that we haven't brought on a new mine. It's a long time that we've been in basically a fairly structural deficit, albeit with stockpiles to cushion the buffer. And then when Cameco announced that they would be, you know, putting on care and maintenance, their flagship mine, and the Kazakhs doing the same, we said, well, I bet this market balances awfully soon. And so we decided to get involved. We were early by a couple years, but that's okay. The stocks were actually have been, you know, good performers, albeit volatile. But now when you kind of rerun those numbers, like I said, whether it's now or 6 months from now or 10 months from now, the pantry's getting awfully bare. And I think that is going to put in sharp relief a market that has been underinvested in for a long time, a market that is extremely tight on its just what I would call primary fundamentals, meaning primary demand from reactors and primary supply from mines. And that's the backdrop.
Adam, Justin and I were talking earlier kind of a little bit of comparing this current move in the spot market, which we're finally seeing spot uranium back over $60 a pound. We haven't seen a move like this for about a year or two when the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust came on. That was the kind of a catalyst for a lot of momentum into not only uranium, but the equities as well. That slowly just kind of dissipated a little bit. In fact, Sprott came out and they hadn't bought any physical uranium in almost majority of this year. Mm-hmm. And then they raised just under $1 million last week, which is good to see. But we were talking about, you know, 2 years ago, Sprott being the catalyst of moving this market. Maybe that was a sign of, you know, it was a good sign for the market, but you can't have a healthy bull market on the back of one company kind of coming onto the market. We're currently where we're sitting at this move in the spot market seems a lot well-rounded, a lot more balanced for a bull market. So I just kind of wanted to get your sense here, you know, the differences between the spot market move now compared to 2 years ago.
No, I think it's a great question. And it was, you know, hotly debated at the time. And we were, you know, as a full disclosure, we owned the Uranium Participation Unit, which was the precursor to the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust. They acquired that, I'm going to guess, in 2021, I think, either 2020 or 2021. And we're holders now. And I'm sure your listeners are very well versed, but in case they're not, you know, this is a closed end fund that has an at the money issuance feature in it, so that when the trust trades at a premium to NAV, it can issue new shares and go buy physical volumes. When it trades at a discount to NAV, it cannot. I don't know if it cannot or it does not. I think it cannot, but in practice, it definitely does not. and that's a closed end fund. So for the most part, and you know, Justin, we were chatting a little bit before the show and about redemption features and stuff like that. But for the most part, you know, I think the market has come to realize that that material is largely trapped in that vehicle, right? So it's not like the GLD, where if there's outflows in a given day, then the trust is outselling gold. This is a closed end fund. If it trades above, it can take you material in. And as of now, anyway, when it trades at a discount, it just kind of sits and cannot. And when it was first introduced, it garnered some interest quite a bit and traded up at a premium, and it issued new shares and it took material off the market. And we estimate that it and its like, so the other, you know, closed end funds that do a similar thing, of which there's Yellow Cake and a couple others, probably has bought about, you know, 80 million pounds of physical material over the last couple of years. So it's a decent sized number. And to your point, you know, particularly in the early days, some of the bears, the uranium bears, of which there's quite a few, came out and said, well, this is, you know, this isn't a true bull market. This is just kind of market manipulation. And the Sprott side of things, I'm not sure that I've ever seen them say this, but my read on that is that, you know, they're a fairly shrewd group of commodity investors. And if you had done this when there was huge excess inventories slushing around the world, you probably wouldn't have garnered much interest and attention. Whereas if you do it when the market is beginning to tighten, it can become a really interesting speculative vehicle. So my read always was that their timing was probably such that they were looking around and say, okay, you know, this market's getting awfully close to an inflection point, and it's starting to look pretty tight. And a lot of those inventories have probably been absorbed into the market, you know, after Fukushima. And so now this will just kind of be a little push to really tighten things. And so that's been the big question, right? Is the market tightening and Sprott is timed it well to be a strong franchise in the space? Or, you know, is the Sprott physical trust actually driving tightness in the market, which would be obviously a less high quality rally, because ultimately, you know, while that material is locked up, quote unquote, in perpetuity, I agree with you that a huge rally based on people putting U308 in a warehouse somewhere seems a bit odd to me. And my view, just to be clear, I think that they timed it well. I think that they saw the writing on the wall. I think that they realized that this market was going to swing from a fairly persistent surplus into a rather structural deficit, and they wanted to be have a vehicle out there and a franchise out there to take advantage of it. Now that we're in this kind of accumulation phase, though, and to your point, right, for the last, like you said, about year, 18 months or whatever it is, it has traded at a fairly persistent deficit to NAV, and it has not issued new shares, and it has not attracted new material. And if you look, actually, my partner Lee was showing me today the relative chart of Yellow Cake, which is probably less influenced by, you know, speculators and short sellers than the Sprott is. And I guess that's the flip side of the coin from having a big franchise, you know, and a vocal team out there, whatever, is that you track the speculative money on both sides. You know, it's performed much, much better because I don't think it's had quite the same level of, you know, arbitrage and short interest that has crept into the Sprott physical uranium. And that has been slowly, slowly, slowly tightening. And that discount to NAV has been slowly grinding away to basically be zero and now trade at a premium for the first time. And so now they're issuing shares again, like you said, fairly meager, but still an important day. And they're out in the market buying again. But I think eventually, by the time this bull market is over, you know, every bear market, if you look at the fundamentals, probably goes down a little bit farther than it ought to based on the fundamentals alone. And every bull market goes farther than it ought to on the fundamentals alone. Oil was in a bear market and we had a surplus, but it probably shouldn't have hit minus $47 a barrel. And, you know, maybe shouldn't have hit 150 on the upside back in 2008, right before, you know, the GFC. And I think in this case with uranium, the last parabolic move here, which we're not anywhere near. We're just in the opening innings, I think. But it's going to be driven by speculators because it's a tiny, tiny market. And all speculators, aggressive speculators, would need to do would be to bull up the Sprott physical, have it traded a premium, which, you could inundate the market with buying pressure, mm-hmm. trades at a premium, it goes out, it buys material. Material's hard to come by. The spot price pops and the value of the Sprott physical uranium pops. And then you just do it over and over and over and over again. And I mean, if you think about like what you would need to do that in the silver market, which the speculators tried to do back in 2022, during when the Reddit crowd got into the silver trade and were ultimately stopped out pretty quick, or the gold trade even would be even more capital. This is peanuts. You could put $1 billion into this as a collective, group of speculators. And I mean, you could really wreak havoc on this market. It's so small. And so I think that, there's just an unbelievable speculative mania that's going to probably spell the end of the bull market at some point, but we're a ways away at this point now.
Adam, we've seen this narrative behind nuclear energy and uranium evolve and improve, I think I can say, over the last couple of years. But as far as like narratives coming from a lot of the financial news, we've seen the likes of Cathie Wood come into uranium. Obviously, Drunken Miller trades in and out of it. And I've also have noticed just on Twitter that a lot of Silicon Valley and some of those tech gurus have gone out and openly discussed interest in uranium and nuclear energy. So this narrative continues to evolve, but I don't think we're necessarily seeing that we're not seeing a fever of speculation quite yet, but could we? I mean, could this be something where the narrative really picks up rather quickly and gets everybody? Are we ill prepared for such a narrative to happen?
Well, I think I'm quite prepared for it. I can't speak for anybody else, but no, I do think so. Look, I think that nuclear power here, if you put on your bullish cap and you think forward at that hypothetical dinner party, at the end of 2029, right? I mean, this does have all of the ingredients for an unbelievable speculative mania. So first of all, it's very futuristic, if you will, right? And it always has been. It's always attracted people's imagination, sort of a Jetsons world of, abundant, cheap, available, clean energy. It is incredibly it's a technological wonder and marvel, the nuclear power industry. I mean, there's really, Vaclav Smil calls it the most successful failure of all time. Success because it delivered absolutely everything, and a failure because we just didn't really adopt it. And the main thing why we didn't adopt it is because we've had cheap, abundant energy, and we haven't worried about, carbon emissions and things like that. And so, there was a rumor going around, which I think is true, but I don't have firsthand evidence that the biggest lobbyists against nuclear power was always the coal industry. And so as long as we've had that cheap, abundant energy in other forms, we haven't quite needed it, I guess. Things are different today, both because we've underinvested across the energy space so dramatically, with capital budgets being cut 70-80% across the board, coal, gas, oil, you name it, and money being diverted into wind and solar, which ultimately cannot carry the day. So you have this technology that has the best energy return on investment. So you put one unit of energy in, you get 100 units of energy out. It's 10 to 20 times better than renewables and 3 to 5 times better than oil and gas. We have new technology on the horizon in the form of these small modular reactors, which I'm happy to talk about at length. We've done quite a bit of work on them. So there's a really, really optimistic, exciting story and narrative, and the type of stuff that, Wall Street and hedge funds just glob onto. And none of that's been put forward yet, right? So you have all that. It's been starved of capital terribly for the last, 30 years, really, right? You have a duopoly where you have Cameco and Kazatomprom are really the only two primary uranium producers, in the world. And I joke that at the bottom of the bear market, you had a duopoly and the duopoly couldn't make money. I've never even heard of that. Normally, if you have like market concentration like that, you have these, really high profit margins. So that's how bad things got. We haven't had any investment in it. And I think we're, we're going to see the impacts of that now. So I think that this is going to get completely out of hand. I think what's interesting, I just finished a lunch with somebody now, and they were saying, what ends the uranium bull market, of which I think has a long way to run. And it's not going to be demand, because absent another major, you know, pivot or pendulum swing by the policymakers, you can jack up the price of uranium and not have it impact the utilities that much. I think what will ultimately happen is when you have prices that are high for a sustained period of time, you will see new supply come online because it's out there. We know, you know, who the players could be. It's going to take time to ramp up. It's not going to be overnight. But ultimately, you know, we think of every commodity market as being having an endpoint, and it's either because you'll have demand destruction or new supply be incentivized to come online. And I think in the case of uranium, it'll be new supply will be incentivized to come online. But we're a ways away from that. So, yeah, I think we have all the recipe for a really frenetic move. I think we have the recipe for a good narrative to come around about it. You know, I could see all the VC funds wanting to get involved in the small modular reactors and the laser enrichments. I mean, there's something for everyone. And at the end of it, what's really exciting and really, I think, optimistic about this whole thing, you know, we used to talk for ages about the energy mistakes that we've made trying to push renewables when they're just so materials intensive, so capital intensive, and really energy intensive to create the energy that we need. And uranium and nuclear power is the answer to all of that. You know, I think that we have a huge bright future ahead by being able to tap into really, you know, abundant, cheap, clean energy. The answer is there. It's just waiting. And I think we're now giving it a fair shake, and people are starting to come to the table.
Adam, I couldn't agree more with pretty much everything you just said. I'm trying to contain myself over here, and I have so many questions and so many directions I want to go. But I think just, you know, what you just stated towards the end of that statement, essentially, that that this, we have a long ways to go, and this could be a very long bull market. And if you had asked me maybe a couple of years ago, especially right after Sprott first came on the scene with their ATM, and the buying was hand over fist, and the price spiked really quickly, and like, well, if capital keeps flowing into this vehicle in the way that it is now, we could spike really, really quickly and end up having a 12 to 18 month bull market for the commodity. And then it would reset and we'd get back to the fundamental case. That obviously didn't happen. And now when I'm looking at the picture, including much of what you just mentioned, the advent of small modular reactors and advanced nuclear designs, Japanese restarting reactors in a more accelerated way, the Chinese build out plans, which are, you know, I was telling Trevor, they've 6 construction starts this year already, and another possible 8 before the end of the year. They're going nuts on nuclear. Oh man, the de-risking the United States through the IRA with, you know, clean energy production tax credits has pretty much every nuclear plant that is supposed to come offline in the next 6 or 7 years is probably going to get life extended. They're even looking at restarting the Palisades plant in Michigan with $150 million in funding from the state to do so. We've never seen this. We've never seen this. It's very exciting. And I think that what we've been communicating with our subscribers, especially over the past year or so, is we think this could be a much longer, much more robust bull market for the commodity. And the big question mark really is the capital flows. And I think you're right. The setup is absolutely there. It's just that one piece that is hard to predict, the when and the how much. But what's beautiful about this setup is that we don't need it. So in your piece, you highlight, I think it was 250 million in pounds in cumulative deficit between now and 2030. And you even state in there that that's probably conservative. I agree. Our numbers are definitely more than that a little bit. But you have to look at what's included in that calculation, right? Because that calculation, and I'm making assumptions about your modeling, which I have not seen, but our modeling that's showing a slightly larger deficit than that basically includes no SMR demand, yep, no financial demand. All the projects slated to come online at the expected price points do come online on time.
Yep.
And we still have this hundreds of millions of pounds deficit. So the fundamental picture is brilliant. The funds flow into the capital players that could or could not squeeze the market. I don't know. That's just gravy. So I guess let me put this into a question, which is, it seems like you guys generally are looking at this as a longer term bull market for the commodity for nuclear energy in general. Is that true?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Do you speculate on here?
Yeah, so that I think that's exactly right. And, you know, when if your listeners read any of our stuff, and I encourage you to do, we put everything out in the public domain. We always try to look out, you know, 3 to 5 years is usually our sweet spot. And, you know, we do a tremendous amount of work in areas of the market. You know, we're value investors. We think that there's value to be had when investors are bearish, when there's no capital. And what's interesting is that I think our thinking has not changed, but it's gotten a little more rounded in recent years, because we used to always be value investors because we always like to, you know, buy a dollar for 50 cents and all that type of good, you know, Graham and Dodd Buffett investing. But in resources, you get a secondary benefit from being value investors, which is that when you get these opportunities of great value tend to coincide with when investors are super bearish, pessimistic, and are starving the industry for capital. And that's important because with resource markets, they deplete, you know, the mines and oil fields deplete. You need to be reinvesting and you always overshoot the mark. So you'll have periods of time where capital flows in and you bring on way too much supply. It works with a lag and you overwhelm demand. And then you have periods of time where you're constricted for capital and things tighten slowly. And obviously the first year you're in surplus, you can constrict the capital and it doesn't have an impact, but eventually it goes too far and you overshoot on the other side. And then you have these huge, you know, violent spikes higher. And so that's what we like to try to find. We like to try to find areas that represent value where you're not overpaying for assets. In fact, you're getting them at, you know, near distressed levels. And certainly buying uranium stocks like Cameco back in 2018 was exactly that. And those themes tend to take a few years to play out. I wish we could be better at calling the exact timing on them, but we're just not. So, you know, some folks out there are really good at timing things and others are better at figuring out the longer term big picture. If you can find someone that does both, that's great. I've not really yet met that person, but, you know, we're very much in the camp on the longer term. So I think that this is going to be a sustainable market. This is not for a trade. You need to recapitalize the industry. Remember, when uranium got down to $19 a pound in 2018, you needed $70 to bring on the next good uranium mine. And their feasibility studies will probably say it's lower than that. But realistically, to get the banks interested and to, you know, deal with cost inflation, you probably need like $70 for it to really make sense. And maybe there's one, you know, which we probably all can think of that works a little bit lower than that. But the bulk of them are even higher probably. And I've never remember seeing a market that was so far out of the money, you know, where the spot price was 19 and the incentive price was 70. And I would joke that we would go to the big mining conferences and there would always be the poor uranium companies weren't allowed to present on their own. They had to present as a group together at this fireside chat. And they would always be like at 6:45 in the morning or some terrible time slot. And they would all sit and talk about how great their projects were. And the feasibility studies were all done at a multiple of the spot price. And, you know, I'm used to looking at a copper project or a gold project where if gold's $1,000, they'll come in and run the feasibility study at 500, or now gold's 2000, they'll run it at 1200, you know, to show how robust it is. Here you had the spot price at 19 and they were running their models at 75. And I said, wow, you know, that's a market I want to get involved with. And then the question is just, do you want the incumbents that, you know, at least can cash flow, or do you want, you know, to take some of these higher beta projects that are basically at that point, we're out of the money call options. And so that's up to every investor and their risk profile. But no, it's going to be a big, sustainable market. I've never seen something that got quite so cheap in terms of the spot price to the incentive price. And, you know, there's reasons for that, but it's amazing. You can really go back and look at the uranium market since 1940 and kind of map it out and see these ebbs and flows. And who knows what the future will bring, but on the path we're going now, we're going to have a pretty persistent deficit for kind of the first time ever, basically starting right now. So I think it's very, very exciting and it has a ways to run.
In this newsletter, Adam, you wrote that, I mean, you basically called the bear market's over in uranium. But what is the other side? I mean, what are the headwinds in front of uranium right now? What we haven't talked about in the last half hour is some of the macro, what's happening in global economies. We haven't talked deglobalization, higher interest rates, a dollar that will just crushing through everything right now over the last couple of weeks. You know, is there a headwind for uranium and nuclear energy on the macro front in the short to medium term here?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. So I'll look, there always is one lurking out there. And so whether you identify it or not is up, you know, up to you. But if I don't come up with one, it's not because it's not out there. It just means we haven't thought of it yet. But look, I'll go through some of the things you just mentioned, right? If you look at, for instance, COVID, right, where energy demand fluctuated quite a bit. And so presumably, if we say we're going to have a big economic headwind, that means that we'll demand less energy. I presume that's kind of the inference, right? If we have an economic headwind and we still need a lot of energy, I think this will work just fine. And if we have a headwind and so we consume less energy, well, let's go back and look at COVID. And uranium and nuclear power is really the last to kind of turn off, right? So we saw gas dispatch go down, coal dispatch go down. Certainly, certainly transportation fuel for a period went down sharply. But nuclear power was very, 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 very resilient. So I don't know that, you know, it's a great market if we have a global coordinated depression. But, you know, I think if you're looking at the energy complex, it seems as though probably because of the large sunk costs and then the low operating costs and the fact that it's difficult to ramp up and ramp down, uranium probably ends up being a little bit more sticky base load there. So I think that's probably okay. Capital interest rate costs are really interesting because this could cut both ways. And there's been a lot of talk in the past about how the cost overruns and the CapEx overruns on uranium have, you know, far exceeded what people expected. And that's particularly true here in the United States. But if you look at where new projects are being sanctioned and built, you know, they're not really facing those same pressures to the same degree, right? Like, I don't think that you could build effectively in the United States right now. Certainly Vogel showed that that was quite challenging. As we bring back our acumen on building nuclear reactors and as we move into SMRs, I think that changes things for the better. But if you look right now, I mean, China's really the story for growth. And I think that they'll be able to contain their costs. And the Koreans and the Chinese are both able to bring on reactors sort of on time, on budget. And there's a sort of second story to rising interest rates here. And that is far and away, the biggest source of cost improvements in wind and solar has been falling interest rates. And a couple of years ago, we did a big research piece where everyone had these, and they still write them, these charts where wind and solar prices had fallen by like 75, 80% over the last decade. And if they only fell like another, you know, they fell from whatever, the numbers that I have stuck in my head here is for batteries, but it's basically the same, right? Batteries fell from $1,000 a kilowatt hour to 150. And if they got them to 100, then it would really compete with the internal combustion engine. And if you think from 1,000 to 150, you know, that's a lot more than 150 to 100. That last little bit should be pretty easy. And it's just a matter of when, not if. And we said, well, wait a second, guys, what happened in this last decade? What actually caused these renewable and EV costs to fall so much? And no one had done that study. And the truth was, everyone thought it was manufacturing acumen and stuff like that. Most of what it was cheaper energy, cheaper materials, which is effectively just embodied energy, like steel and concrete and stuff like that. And then cheaper cost of capital, because your renewables are all CapEx loaded compared to traditional forms of energy. And so we made the case, we said, look, not only will this last 30% be really difficult to get, but if we normalize interest rates and if we bring up the cost of energy and materials, we could actually see costs increase. And that was never something that anyone had in their models, right? That was sort of like a foregone conclusion, like housing before the GFC can only go up, you know, wind and solar costs can only go down, their margins can only improve. And that's been shown to be incorrect. And you're seeing a huge amount of impairments. You know, Ørsted was down 30% last week because they took these big write-offs on Commonwealth and others. So would rising interest rates help or hurt nuclear? I think it's a more nuanced question, because it would definitely, definitely hurt renewables. And so to the extent that, you know, you see a moment of reckoning on what has been the big green push in the last 10 or 15 years, I think that could work very favorably for uranium nuclear power, but remains to be seen, I suppose. And then, you know, unfortunately, I think there's always the public perception of safety and the public perception of, you know, nuclear energy as being an acceptable form, an acceptable risk to take on as a society, which I think, and I'm sure your listeners do think, is absolute rubbish. You know, any way you look at it objectively, nuclear power is by far the safest form of energy that's ever been brought online. It's an industry that works with exceptionally high safety standards. And if you look back on the kind of three nuclear accidents in the last, you know, in the history of the nuclear age, with Chernobyl being the only one that really had, you know, devastating consequences. And that was basically a weapons program done with no containment vessel and no safety standards to speak of. So it's very, very, very safe. But of course, the risk is always out there that public perception shifts, and whether, you know, that can happen for many number of reasons. So that's, I think, to me, that's the biggest risk, is that the public sours to nuclear energy again, which right now seems to not be happening. It seems to be working as a tailwind. People seem to be coming back and rediscovering nuclear power for the first time or again. But, you know, people's opinions can be fickle.
Well said, Adam. I'm very curious. You wrote about, in again, referencing your Q2 piece, the importance of commercial inventories. And I know that you're familiar, and listeners of the show are probably familiar, but just really, really quickly, the fuel cycle for nuclear utilities basically is 18 to 24 months on average. The mined material has to be converted, enriched, fabricated into fuel prior to being loaded into the core. Because of this lag time needed for mined uranium to actually be turned into fabricated fuel, utilities generally hold a decent amount of inventories. So in the U.S., on average, at least 2 years. In the EU, they push for three or more. But we know that these inventory buffers, they kind of cycle up and down on very, very long-term cycles. And you highlighted in this piece that utility inventories now are at levels that are similar to prior to the big run in the mid-2000s. Tell us about the importance of commercial nuclear utility inventories and where they're at now, and what are the likely outcomes in the next few years in terms of long-term contracting due to this low inventory level?
Sure. So, you know, again, very different from oil and gas. You know, it's a very opaque market, and you have to kind of, the way we've tried to do it, I think a lot of analysts just say, well, you know, it's not part of the index. I don't really need to do this at all and stay away. Our approach is a little bit different. You know, we try to take a best guess and look, if we're not going to look month to month or week to week, at least look year to year, decade to decade, right? And so, again, if you look through these different periods of uranium cycles going back all the way back to 1945 or whatever, we're definitely in a period now where we are drawing down on the commercial inventories. We're at a period, though, where after Fukushima, we had built them up to basically all-time industry highs, almost as high as they were back in 1983, which was a terrible time in the uranium business. And so the utility buyer has basically grown up in an environment where it has always paid to kind of push and always paid to try to, you know, stay under contracted a little bit because you had this buffer at your disposal in the form of these excess commercial inventories. Because we have to be careful, right? We have commercial inventories, then we have like excess commercial inventories, because part of it, like you said, is tied up in the fuel cycle. And frankly, it's been the right call, with the exception of from 2019 to today, but even two-thirds of that, it was basically kind of even money. So with the exception of the last kind of 18 months, it was the right call to wait and see. Because if you got a downdraft, you could contract at low prices. And, you know, if things seem to get tight, you had this excess buffer of commercial inventories. That's really different now. And I think that there's, for the first time, a little bit more of a physical shortage than those buyers are used to seeing. And as a result of that, I think people are starting to get a little bit panicky. And so that's always been a big, big question mark, is like, when are these fuel buyers going to wake up and look to contract out for the better part of the next decade? And they just haven't yet. Right. And I think that's what we're hearing anyway, because it's all played very close to the vest. But we're hearing that's beginning to change a little bit. And as that begins to change, you run the risk of having all these fuel buyers bid for scarce physical volumes all at the same time. And, you know, kind of everyone rush through the exit. And that's when you're going to get, you know, a melt up, I think, where the speculators are then going to say, oh my God, all these guys are scrambling, looking for material. Why don't I bid up the Sprott physical and take some more material off the market? And it's just going to get really out of hand. So I think we're right on the cusp of that. And I think, you know, you look at some of the contracting behaviors and the differences between spot and term prices. And of course, not all those term prices get reported. But I think you're starting to see a little bit more of a sustained up movement there because these guys are under contracted as we look out.
Agreed. Yeah. The forward curve looks pretty dramatic. I mean, most of the first mover utilities are decently covered for the next few years. But at the same time, you know, the primary producers, Cameco, Kazatomprom, Orano, you know, none of them have sufficient material or a lot of material available until, you know, 2026 and beyond. So there's not a lot of production. And even though these players, you know, Orano, maybe they sell through their trading arm to the spot market a little bit, but they're structurally short anyways. So these big players are not really spot market sellers anyways. So the spot market is going to be remaining thin as, you know, utilities go to these big players to secure their long-term U308 needs. And the term price, in my opinion, is only going to continue to go higher and higher. And to your point, you know, U308, I think it's somewhere around 3-4% of the operating budget of a nuclear power plant on average. Yeah. And of course, you know, it doesn't go up in a vacuum, you know.
And that's probably on contracted pricing, right?
Right.
So that's probably, you know, closer to where you are now, not where you were at the bottom, I would presume.
Yeah. I mean, even at $18 a pound spot, you know, utilities are paying in the 20s term. And they're closer to each other now than they have been kind of over the past number of years. But yes, I believe that's correctly. But yeah, I mean, the U308 price doesn't necessarily go up in a vacuum. You know, the conversion enrichment price has been going up significantly. And the rising SWU price, in my opinion, not only is representative of, you know, a lacking capacity in Western enrichment based, you know, relative to Western demand, but also, you know, enrichers in the West are raising the prices for SWU to try to cover their own losses coming from having to buy material to overfeed. So they're having to raise those operational tails. And in order to do that, they kind of have to borrow from Peter to pay Paul. So their transactional tails going out into the later part of the decade are way higher and the SWU prices is rising. It's all just kind of snowballing at the same time. And we've been stating for the last, you know, 12 months and longer that utilities, of course, they go towards the end of the fuel cycle services first. If you are uncovered, you're going to try to get that enriched uranium first. If you can't buy EUP, you're going to buy UF6 and have it enriched. If you can't buy UF6, you're going to buy U308 and have it converted. But the first movers went to enrichment first, then conversion. Now it's coming to U308, and we're starting to see that. I honestly think that literally just started to happen maybe last month, the month before. It's the super early stages to this. It's super exciting.
No, I think that's exactly right. And you know, it is a complicated, convoluted market. And I'm sure your listeners are a self-selected group and probably get it more than most. But you know, this idea of underfeeding and overfeeding and tail enrichments and things like that, and SWU, you know, I'm almost tempted sometimes to just not even go there because it just complicates things so much. But you're absolutely right. And what you've seen is just a general tightening across the entire supply chain, basically starting with the enrichment side of things back a couple years ago when SWU first spiked and then remained sustainably high. And that was always the big shock, was that when SWU first popped, everyone thought it was completely temporary, and it turns out it's not. You have this underfeeding, overfeeding issue, which is now spilling back. Like you said, you know, it's like the watertight compartments on a boat. It's just going spilling from one to the next, to the next, to the next. I don't know if that's the right analogy, because I guess the boat sinks at the end. So we don't want that. But, you know, I think the point is the same. And you know, that's before we even get into the idea of Russia's invasion of the Ukraine and the impact that that's having on the enrichment market. Because I mean, we're also now bifurcating the markets again. And if you think back, right, and that period of time beginning in 1983 all the way to 2010, where you saw massive spilling out of materials, both uranium and other commodities, frankly, from the Soviet Union as it moved towards its ultimate kind of swan song, right? That created a lot of synergy, I guess, by not having to keep two separate supply chains in the world. And that depressed commodity prices through most of the 1990s. And now it looks like we're putting up walls and moving back into the opposite direction with massive redundancy throughout many supply chains. And we can debate whether, you know, PGMs will do that or whether nickel will do that. But I guarantee you that the idea of security of supply for nuclear enrichment and nuclear domestic production, now whether Canada counts as domestic remains to be seen. But, you know, I promise that is at the forefront of critical minerals and critical processes. And so I think that that's just going to tighten up things a lot more. I don't think we can rely. I think we have to rely on Russian enrichment, but that's not going to be a palatable solution here. For much longer, if it even is anymore today.
Justin, do you have any last questions here? I mean, there's so much information here.
I have two last questions, but they can be pretty rapid fire. Are you comfortable with sharing just as a rough percentage of your funds, AUM, how you're allocated to uranium?
Yeah, we have about 15 or 16% uranium.
Nice. And I'm going to ask you a question that everybody asks me, and I don't always like this question, but I'm going to ask it anyways. What inning are we in?
Oh, I think it's very, very early. I mean, I think $19 a pound that we saw back in 2018 was way too low. I think 40 to 50 is kind of, you know, a bear market bottom. And now we're coming off of that. So second, I mean, this is going to get out of hand. The market's too small, and it's going to go I could just see the story. I can see the speculative fervor. And so in any bull market, I like to differentiate between two parts. One is radically undervalued to kind of fair, and one is fair to radically overvalued. And since we're value investors, we're uneasy in that second half where you go, you know, from fair to radically overvalued. But the truth is that things very rarely stop at fair. They overshoot on both sides. And so, you know, I think we're somewhere between radically undervalued and fair. You know, if we could get uranium prices to $80 and pin them there, and bankers began to think that, you know, an $80 uranium price was bankable and stable, you could start to bring on new supply and probably meet our needs in the next 5 to 7 years. But you're going to way overshoot that in the process.
I think that's a really, really good point. It's easy to look at a chart and say, oh, well, it's already gone from $18 to $61 a pound. Like, how much more upside could there be? But you're right. I mean, the bear market, the fair bear market bottom should have been somewhere probably right around that $35 to $45 a pound. And it undershoot by a significant margin. So, and we're still agreed. We're still not at fair. The big players are making a little bit of money here, but the marginal projects, we still have got $20 to $30 a pound to go for those marginal projects to even think about starting to develop. And I think I'm right there with you on that one. So thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Thank you for your time. Yeah. I've always enjoyed your work. I love the long-term vision that you guys have for your investing style. It matches mine very nicely. So keep up the great work. Thank you for your time, and hope you have a great day.
Oh, thank you so much. This was a real pleasure. Happy to come back. We'll talk about every market you want.
Thanks, Adam. Hey, how can people follow your work before we let you go?
Well, we put everything on our website. You know, just type in Gehring and Rosenzweig into Google. There's only one of us. You know, you'll find there's not pages and pages of Gehring and Rosenzweigs out there. The website is GoRosen, GoRozen.com. And that's probably the easiest way. We put everything we do out in the public domain. Just sign up and we'll send it to you.
And anybody who's listening, I just want to mention, please go back, go to their website, read that latest commentary on Q2. It's high quality stuff. So thank you again, Adam.
Thank you.
The information presented should not be considered investment advice. Going Nuclear, Justin, or myself, and the Clear Commodity Network team and its affiliates are not responsible for any loss arising from any investment decision in connection with the material presented herein. Please do your own research or speak with a licensed financial representative before making any investment decisions.